Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intelligence Brief, where we bring you the best of what you may have missed this week and things that you need to have to get by and to understand the world around you. We are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth. And in case you missed any of the important stuff this week, and a lot of things did happen this week, we want to make sure that you get it here in this end of week review. Gary and I are here with you to make sure that you get that. And we're going to start off with one of our favorites that we have every week, but he was in especially rare form this week, even though he was absent his normal shirt, and that's Larry the Shirt Johnson.
Well, it took me a couple of years to understand this, but I'm confident that I've got it correct. What we've seen with Russia, one of the criticisms that emerges out of the West is, oh, look how slow the Russians are moving. They've only been able to take this limited amount of territory, et cetera. And yet, when we look at the actual number of Russian forces, they've been building up slowly. They've not been in a panic. And what I mean by a panic, they haven't declared a national emergency at which they've mobilized, because they've got the potential to upward of 15 million men that they could mobilize immediately, reservists. What we've seen in 2025 is finally Russia had reached a level of strength on the front lines that right now they are conducting 9 separate offensive operations all along that 1,300-kilometer line of contact. Significant. They've never done that before. They didn't do it in 2023, 2024. In each of those years, they were limited to 1, possibly 2 offensive operations. But now they've got the strength, the troop strength to do it. NATO still, after, you know, we're coming upon the fourth year of this, has still been unable to solve the problem of producing sufficient weapons and, you know, go down the category, drones, artillery shells, tanks. In no area does NATO have superiority or dominance over Russia. Not a single one.
You know, Gary, one of the things that really that episode brought out is it addresses a lot of the things that we hear over and over in the Western media, and it literally has never stopped, to include this week, to where we hear reports that the Russian economy is on its knees, it's wobbling, it's going to fall over at any time, and that the Ukraine side is increasing its production capacity of fill in the blank, whatever it is, that the Russians are potentially going to turn against Putin, that they're not winning. And, you know, some of these former generals in the United States, Ben Hodges being one of the key ones, keeps on talking about that. And then yet Larry comes on and says, listen, the Russians are not motivated and not prompted into action by some of these claims. They may have some impact in the West. It may make people mad. It may rankle some people even in Russia, but they've kind of like said, you know what, we're going to let our actions do our talking. And in fact, let me mention or show something that Larry was mentioning here, because he said that what Russia has doing now is that they are able to fight all across the front. He mentioned that in the past they had to go into one or two areas. Let me just focus in on a couple so you can see what he was talking about. There was a long time, and I guess it was mostly in 2024, where the city of Bakhmut was like the primary effort. And almost the only thing you had and all along the remainder of the front line was just holding operations to where the Russians wanted to make sure that the Ukraine side didn't conduct any offensive. But nearly everything was focused around Bakhmut here. And then Avdiivka after that, kind of sequentially, they went from one to the other. But now then, as he points out, he said there's not. I'm not sure which nine he was referring to, but I can certainly point out that there is in the Zaporizhia area down in the rest, in this area around Orakhiv, in the area of Nikopol. Then we can move up a little bit further into, obviously, the Huliapoli. I think I've been telling you about that recently. There's been some operations, offensive operations near Orakhiv, so that's a separate one. Then, naturally, the one we talk about a lot is the Pokrovsk area, but even before that, you see this new area around here that's south of this. This is not the Pokrovsk you're thinking. It's Pokrovsk. It's a little bit different, but you see that in the Vishne area where the Russians continue to make movements here. This is its own separate operation. And then we do come up to the Novopavlivka. This one is the next one in line here. Again, Russian advances getting right up to the outskirts of that city, naturally in the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd conglomerate. Again, overnight, this huge advancement in the entire eastern part of Mirnograd. So this continues to get cut off more. The battle in Rodinska keeps going on. Then up in Shakhova, this one is continuing to happen. Then let's go all the way to Seversk. We've been talking about that a long one. This area up around here, Novosilka, that is continuing the operation. It's not moving as much as some of the others, but you see there's a lot of action up in here. And then the other big one, of course, is the Kupiansk, where the Russians have taken a significant portion of that city. We'll zoom in here so you can see the streets. And you see there's just not much of the city left. All these areas where the Russians have now turned into a gray zone. So this is a large area of gray zone, and that leaves very little in between where the Ukraine side has full control. And then the last one I want to point out, too, is you come up into the Kharkiv area around Volchansk, where they continue to see that's new fresh stuff that they've advanced. So they're moving further south right there. This one little area up in here in the north, and then in the east again, Russia continues to have this buffer zone thing they put up. But you see, all of these have been going on simultaneously all across the front. So Ukraine can't focus in any one spot without causing big holes and gaps in the front line. And he talked about how Russia is just continuing to go on. Sorry, let me remove that. He's talked about how Russia is just content with saying, we're going to continue to increase our manpower. We're going to continue to increase our weapons of war. We're going to continue to advance in the way that we fight. And we've seen that in some of the other episodes this past week. Stanislav was one of them, talking about how Russia is adjusting the methods that it fights with. And they're continuing to overcome a lot of this stuff. And the Ukraine side is literally struggling just to hang on. They don't have the opportunity in any of those cases. And I think the net of that, Gary, was just, I mean, we know where this war is heading.
Yeah. I think you ended up naming those 9 points that Larry was talking about. I wasn't counting, but it seems like you hit all hit all the major conflicts there. Yeah, you know, Danny, I think, and what the media ends up doing, just point to the shiny object of sanctions going on, because they don't dare look at what you just demonstrated so clearly on the map there. So it's an easier ploy. It's an easier play to just say, you know, what they think is going to be happening and how they think these sanctions are really going to be crippling, when indeed, because if they dare, you know, roll out a map the way you just did, there's the nuts and bolts of what's happening.
And you know, and we also showed this past week some of these conferences. One of the big ones is the U.S. senators in the aftermath of a lot of the bad things that have been happening, especially in the air, that's just been just pummeled and just merciless attacks by the Russian side against the Ukraine, especially in Kyiv. I think on Thursday night this past week, there was another big barrage, knocked the capital out of electricity. It was just awful like that. And yet, in light of that, we have U.S. senators talking about the great leadership that Zelensky's playing. And
what I'd like to know on the military front is, besides the Tomahawks, where can we be most helpful? Because I know continued military aid is very important, whether it's the Patriot missile interceptors or other weapon systems that would be helpful to you.
I wanted to first thank you for your leadership. Thank the Ukrainian people for their courage. I don't have a question, but I wanted to let you know, I know the ambassador is following this very closely. In the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Risch, who couldn't join us today, is the chair. I'm the ranking member. But we have put forward the first three bills out of the committee to address, to go after Russia because of their actions.
Thank you for your leadership on this. And Gene, the same. Mr. President, you've got just amazing group of champions of Ukraine here on the Zoom. It's good to see you again.
The rest of the year and beginning of 26, we're going to go all in, giving you military capability to hurt the Putin war machine even more. And we're going to try to isolate Putin even stronger than we have today. If we can pass this bill making Russia a state sponsor of terrorism under U.S. law, that makes his economy radioactive.
Right.
Amen.
Danny, I think it's talking about amen. When's the last time you saw so many people singing from the same hymnal like that?
You know what? That's exactly what I was about to say. I'm really glad you pulled this up because the context here should not be lost on anybody. These guys, all these different senators from both parties, were literally at each other's throats just days before and actually weeks before during the government shutdown, where they were just vicious against each other and accusations or whatever. And now all of a sudden, as you say, from the same little sound book, the sound song they're singing, amens and all that stuff
about in harmony, no less.
It was incredible. Really? I couldn't help but think, as an American, I wish you guys would be that solidified in getting our own damn government running and working together for our benefit instead of focused on going after Vladimir Putin.
But, so just what it takes to get unity, Danny?
I mean, you're talking about a shiny object, but it's like, yeah, man, it feels like the little cat with a little laser ball and how easily they're being manipulated here and how happy they are. Yay, yay, going after this. And, of course, Zelensky was sitting there with all this kind of thing. And yet no one mentioned the battle lines anywhere. No one even talked about that. And no one talked about the number of desertions on the Ukraine side. No one talked about the number of casualties on the Ukraine side. No one talked about the stealing of people off the streets that they can't come close to getting enough. None of those things were mentioned. And yet this passes for the elites, the foreign policy elites of the United States. What does that tell you, man?
You know, you saw how proud they were of themselves. Right? Didn't you hear that kind of coming through, what they were doing? Well, just getting together. We're all doing the right thing together. We're saving the world almost, right?
That puts us all in a pretty bad situation.
Kidding.
Speaking of things not going that good is Bill Buford, who's a historian. He was one of our first time guests that we had this week. He was examining the issue that many say, well, why didn't Russia just take out Zelensky?
Can Zelensky be assassinated tomorrow morning? I happen to think the Russians have not done that because he's such a convenient stooge for them, because I think the Russians are very savvy when it comes to external espionage, human intelligence, and that kind of thing. The possibility is certainly there, but who's waiting in the wings to take his place? Another bad actor. I mean, I am hard-pressed to look at allies that we've had since the end of World War II in August 1945, who are not only not so credible partners of the United States, but have not been manipulated by the United States for what the deep state and the intelligence community thinks is best for us.
Isn't that amazing, Gary, that you're talking about? No, the Russians haven't taken out Zelensky because he's a useful stooge. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I tell you, that rings true to me. The other part of him being the illegitimate president that he is also. So not only politically do they have the angle, Russia, so keeping him in the place, but then legally, he's illegitimate to begin with. So it's a win-win situation by leaving him there.
Yeah, and you know, the other issue is, who would they go to next that would have any more legitimacy? And listen, I have heard many people talk about this, and I tend to agree with it, that if Russia wanted to take him out or the entire government, they could do it in a day. And I mean a literal day, within a matter of hours, with the Oreshnik, because the Oreshnik has the ability, wherever he is in his bunkers, at the minute that they know he's in one of these bunkers, they can take the bunker out because it can go way deeper, at least what's reported, even than our bunker buster bombs, the ones we allegedly used on Iran to go after their nuclear weapons facility. These apparently can go much deeper because they're flying at much higher velocities, the hypersonic, et cetera. And I think that they could probably do that. But then, I'll just say, by the way, I don't think that's off the table yet, because I think that in the event that the situation is starting to collapse and go down and Russia is looking for a decisive end, I think that's a card they could play. Whether they will or not, I don't know. Yeah. But it's interesting that Russia finds utility in keeping this guy in charge, because the other issue is that just imagine if you replace him with somebody who was very capable, somebody else might be able to do some things that were a little bit more harmful to Russia, as opposed to this guy who's quite frankly pretty limited in his military understanding. So there may be that.
It makes perfect sense, I think.
And but that's one of the ironies is that and Zelensky this week has been this past week was a couple of times he was down not far from Pokrovsk. He took a picture in front of a sign. He went down to Kherson on the 3-year anniversary of the Russians being forced out of the city, et cetera. So he keeps going down a little bit more and more to try to rally the troops, et cetera. I'm not sure that really has much effect anymore. And speaking of things that don't have effect, Andrei Martyanov was talking about some of the Russian intent, that they're not just to kind of draft off what Larry was talking about this 9 points and this whole line at the front. One of the claims that against the Russians is that they're going this really slow pace because they can't go any faster. And this shows the limitation of them. But Andrei Martyanov was saying they have a different objective.
So it will continue as long as it takes until, and you know what, it's now going around Russia in a very open manner. You wanted to fight it to the last Ukrainian? Well, do it. There will be last Ukrainian. So when they will decide to do something about inside Kyiv, nobody cares anymore in Russia. Honestly.
So you know, even if it took years.
So yeah, it's until it will be the barren land with no male population which can procreate, because I repeat it again and again. Many people think, oh yeah, he's so cynical. No, I'm not cynical. And I know how horrifying it sounds. Russia is in the business of basically killing the rest of the sperm bank of Ukrainian men. Simple as that. Because their betrayal, many people do not understand metaphysical and cultural issue here between Russians and Ukrainians. Russians do not view Ukrainians as brotherly people anymore. That's the whole thing. Putin obviously cannot say, you know, cannot come out or Lavrov and say, oh no, yeah, we're gonna kill them all and we don't care. He said he have to go out. He have to massage public opinion that, yeah, for us it is the tragedy. In some sense it is the tragedy, but there is no pity or sympathy anymore to Ukraine because their level of betrayal.
You know, he's talking about the level of betrayal, and he's talking about the sperm bank and the progenitor and all that stuff. That is so much bigger of an issue, and one of the reasons I wanted to highlight this today. The replacement value, the replacement value is called, in terms of the number of births to the number of deaths in a country, the number of births you have to have in order to maintain your population, you have to have a higher than that number if you want to grow your population, is 2.01. We're below that too, but we're closer than these guys. Right now, because of all this stuff in the war, they're at 0.98. So they have already, everything that's happened up to this point has already doomed Ukraine to, they're going to continue to shrink even after the war is over, whenever that turns into be. And now then they're actually talking about, Klitschko this past week also said, how about we lower the mobilization age to 22? Let's bring even more people in. So let's destroy even more of that. That's what is so perverse, Gary, is that Andrei was talking about how, you know, the Russians have said, hey, this is what you want that we're going to do. So they are just slowly, methodically destroying the Ukrainian armed forces. And the West is just oblivious to saying, we're going to just like coal into an engine, we're going to shovel more and more bodies in there. And now they're going to go even further into it, not realizing that they are not just destroying the country today, they're destroying its future as well. They could literally destroy the Ukrainian state, whatever is left out of this. Yeah. And the numbers are right there. It wasn't hard for me to find it. They're available. But we are oblivious to it. And you had, again, that disgusting, I'm just going to call it that, image of the U.S. senators lathering all over themselves about the leadership of the guy who's leading his country to a complete destruction. And yet they're talking about more weapons and more ammunition.
Right. It's
crazy.
Yeah. You never hear them address this ever in all the years that this war has been going on. They never address this point, of course, because they can't address it because they have no answers for it. Well, we don't either, because it's demolition supreme that's going on. So it's not going to be relieved through any kind of war efforts. It's going to be relieved through negotiation and peace efforts, which they're not interested in. Right. You know, it's funny. And then even John Mearsheimer, who we had on this week, he described what he thought was going to happen is to be ending up being an ugly, frozen conflict. And then what does that look like once we hit that frozen conflict?
And by the way, for those who may not, I wish I had said this when we had him on the show. Some people don't understand what frozen conflict means. They think it's like the Korean Peninsula or something where there's a frozen line in the middle. Frozen conflict just means that it's not something that's going to end, and there's just constant friction and constant fighting. In a sense, like what happened with the 8-year civil war that preceded February 2022, where there was just this constant line and fire going back and forth between the two sides, and with whether it's partisan activity, et cetera, in the some of the Russian controlled areas, those kind of things, that means that the war is frozen and that it's not in there. It's just continually bleeding people out on either side of it. And that's why it's so pernicious.
Yeah. And ugly.
Yeah, and that's your future, and that's on top of already the lower reproduction rate, which is leading to the literal death of your country if something didn't dramatically happen to turn that around. And unfortunately, we don't seem to be moving in that direction. One of the other things I wanted to point out from that one here is that there is a change now than even about a year ago. There was still some talk from Putin himself and from others that we have been interviewed over the years on this war from the Russian side, and that they said, well, we're still of the same ethnic origins, still the kind of the same Slavic people, and we just got to get this over with. And the West has poisoned the minds of these people against us. But once we get that fixed, you know, we can get back to. And now then, Andre was saying that's not the case anymore. Some people give lip service, he said, at the head of state level or so. He said, but now apparently the people he talks to, they say, yeah, we're done with that. So we don't even dare. We're now, they're just enemies, and that makes it easier to destroy them, frankly.
Right, exactly. There's no remorse.
Yeah, and that's one of the longer wars go, and we've seen this. We certainly saw it in World War II. We saw it in the Pacific, even from the American side, definitely from the Japanese side. War makes beasts of all the participants, and I don't care how high your values and morals are. When you just fight and kill and destroy, and your people are killed and destroyed that often, it turns beasts into the best of men. And the longer this goes on, the worse it is for everybody.
And less incentive to seek peace.
Now let's move on to what the Russians are saying. Sergei Lavrov has been talking a lot of times. He said earlier this week that, by the way, the Russians are still at the same deal that they were before. And we've shown it many times. Vladimir Putin from June 14th of 2024, when he made a specific talk about how that he would end the war by negotiations if there was the demilitarization, denazification, administrative borders of the four areas that were done, and there would be no NATO, so neutrality status for Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov this week, and I want to say it was Thursday, maybe even been Friday, said, all those conditions are still. He literally mentioned that very statement by Putin on the 14th of June, 2024, said those are still in the case. And then one of the reporters, when Sergei Lavrov was asking that, asked him, by the way, about this whole denazification issue, what does that mean?
Zelensky regularly poses on television screens, awarding fighters of Azov and other Nazi battalions with patches of fascist Germany on their sleeves. How else should one relate to this person? That is why Nazism is an undeniable, I mean, the destruction of Nazism in Ukraine, denazification is an indispensable condition for a settlement if we want it to be long-term. And we want that and we'll achieve it.
Now, one of the areas where I had potentially some disagreement with John Mearsheimer was he said, well, there's no way that they're going to go on and conquer all of Ukraine. He thought they would get into this ugly frozen conflict, et cetera. But when I hear Sergei Lavrov say there with such conviction, this is non-negotiable, because he said and I can't remember who it was, maybe we had on our show sometime this week, they said it would be like the Nazis, the Soviet Union during the first Nazi time in World War II, stopping at the border between Germany and Poland and saying, all right, we'll just fight, we'll just end the war here, leaving all the literal Nazis in power. And he said, no, they weren't going to do that. They went until it was completely destroyed and Berlin was in ashes. And the leader of the Nazis, Adolf Hitler, was dead in a bunker. And it seems to me that if the any kind of a settlement, even if the Russians went to the Dnieper River, which John did suggest, or went all the way past and took Odessa or Kharkiv and then up to the very gates of Kiev and they said, all right, we'll make a deal here, I'm not sure that they would stop there. And I've actually talked to some folks, Gary, who are kind of have they claim anyway, access to what the Russians are thinking, at least among the Kremlin folks, there's some that says, yeah, listen, we're going to have to go and conquer the entire area. The entire country is going to have to be defeated because it's the only way to denazify the area. And they even say, and we understand, and they have apparently calculated a 5-year period after the conquest that says that they understand that they're going to have partisan warfare for a long time. And apparently they've looked back into the post-World War II area, how long it took to get a lot of those. And Hungary was a big area where a lot of that happened for a lot longer. Yugoslavia, same situation, but those things eventually burned out. And apparently some of the thinking in the Ukraine, and who know, or the Kremlin, who knows whether it's Putin or not, that we don't know. But at least some of the thinking there is that because of what happened in World War II, we've got to do the same thing here, or we have a negotiated settlement where they do it on their own. But if they don't do it on their own, we will. What do you think of that?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a bleak outlook. No, I don't think they're going to do it on their own. There's no indication of that whatsoever, right, that they're going to do it on their own. The other thing is that with Lavrov, did they, meaning, you know, NATO, us, Trump, did they actually think they're going to wear him down? They're not wearing him down at all. He is so insistent and so dependable on what he is seeking, what Russia is seeking. They're not wearing him down.
He's never wavered on it whatsoever. Never. Him or Putin, either one. They've been very, we seem like we tried to use a PSYOP operation and trying to convince people in the West that all of a sudden Putin got mad at Lavrov and he was on the outs for a while. I think that was kind of weird from the beginning. I've never seen any actual evidence of it. Definitely wasn't yesterday when he made those comments. So I doubt there's a lot on that. And I think that they're just willing to say, yeah, whatever y'all say, we're going to keep doing what we're going to do. And I really do think that one of the reasons why Russia is continuing to stockpile up all these weapons, while they're continuing to stockpile up ammunition and personnel, and they have changed to kind of a year-round situation where they mobilize people, and then they're building up their reserves. I think Larry said in that first soundbite that they could have up to 15 million total in reserves. But from what I understand from looking at it closer, of those that have got recent military experience, there's about 3 million. 3 million on top of the active force of 1.5 million. So that tells me that if they actually wanted to conquer the whole thing, they could activate those reserves. And instead of a special military operation, which has legal limitations within Russia, they could go on to say, all right, now it's just a war. And then they could bring up those mobilized reserves. But they have the trained men in sufficient quantities to just steamroll the rest of Ukraine if they want to. And I think that would be a bad situation, because then that would just supercharge the fears of all of the Western alliance, especially those countries that are on the border, like the Baltics, which would be almost helpless to a concerted Russian assault. And they might be fearing that it would actually happen. And then the very thing that we claim that we've been trying to prevent, Russia moving beyond it, could come to pass. And that's one of the reasons why I hope Russia doesn't do that, because it would definitely provide justification for all of Europe to say, ah, I told you so, what we've been warned about. And then we have the chance for a literal continental wide war, which could go nuclear. So we're not out of the woods yet. And I worry about the Russian proclivities.
And Danny, wasn't it to Stanislav? I think it was him when we had him on this week, that he actually talked about the rotating of troops out in and out of active war. And that cycling, that rotating was, you know, a very efficient way to keep men healthy and fresh and ready to be on the attack.
That's right. And that's one of the things that is completely lacking on the Ukraine side, where there are some people, hard to believe they've survived this long, but there are some that have been on the front lines for like 2 and 3 years because they don't ever get rotated off. They don't ever get, because there's not enough. There's a lot of people that leave, they go AWOL, they desert outright, or of course they get killed or wounded. And all they do is put more people in, but they don't rotate units out. And that's, of course, one of the worst ways to conduct
that brutal
warfare. But the additional benefit on the Russian side is that it expands the experience level for Russia, too, both at the individual and at the collective unit level. So that makes their army bigger and more capable. Another interesting thing that Stanislav said this week, which I really got my attention, is that he said Russia could have one of these big arrow movements if they wanted to, because they have the personnel, they have the equipment, they have the ammunition, they have everything they need. But up to this point, they have been unwilling to do so in part because of the terrain right now with all the mud. They wouldn't do it right now, but the winter's coming up when it would be solid, or the following summer when it would be solid to dry, et cetera. So those are two windows which could be coming up. But he said because they aren't willing to suffer the higher level of casualties that would be necessary at the initial point of penetration. But the issue is, once you have that initial point, and apparently they are aware of this, once you have that spike in friendly casualties, once you get through, there's nothing on the other side. And then, as we've talked about on so many occasions over the last year and a half, Russia could literally just drive wherever else they wanted to because there's no more fortifications or enemy. So at some point, Russia could change its calculation. They haven't yet. And again, I just really hope they don't. All right, let's move on here, because one of the last things we want to talk about here today is something that was said on I want to say it was Thursday by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, when he was answering some questions about some of the support that the United States was giving to Ukraine. And one of the interesting things he said, which didn't get hardly any press at all, we've made mention of it here, and I definitely want to highlight it here because this is an important thing here, is he was talking about the air defense interceptors, the tremendous increase in the assaults that the Russians are making on the Ukraine energy grid throughout their attack. There was another big one from Thursday night into Friday morning in Ukraine, which knocked power out in huge parts of Kiev. The capital city went completely dark for the second time in a week. Ukraine is finding harder and harder to recover from all those. And so Rubio was asking about that. And at the end of it, he let something slide, which I think was a little bigger deal than he may have realized.
The challenge is that Ukraine's energy grid has been diminished each year. So that's why we've been in discussions with them about defensive weapons. But ultimately, if that equipment is destroyed a week later after it's installed, that remains a problem.
If it's restored a week later, it's a problem.
How is it? I have not seen one headline about this at all anywhere. And how is it that we're the only ones that are... What's that?
You search the headlines. You look every day. So
nowhere. I think they wanted to bury this as quickly as it happened. What did he just say? Ditch it. We are the only ones that are even making note of it. I don't see anywhere of this being mentioned that he just said that. You want to burn money? Okay, yeah, let's burn some money. Who does that?
And then it goes back to that one we showed about the senators. They seem oblivious to that too. They're still. He was talking about, I forget, Blumenthal, I think, was talking about Tomahawks and some of the others about, air defense missiles, air defense missiles. Zelensky's talking about that ad nauseum. And there was one report with some video evidence that suggested that some of the new air defense Patriot batteries, because remember, there was Zelensky talked about they had just recently gotten a new Patriot battery. On Thursday night, there was evidence that that battery was destroyed, and they showed some video evidence that suggested it could have. It wasn't conclusive, but in light of what Rubio said, it all may well have been the exact same thing.
All of it gets destroyed within a week.
And look, it's priority targets for the Russians, and that's one of the reasons why they have these big barrages, because you can only fire so many of these interceptors up there, and then as soon as you've shot your load, before you can load them back up, because that takes some time, the next wave comes in, and that's it. They're done. And we see that the missiles and the drones, I mean, they continue to get through every time in some percentage. Even if you knock some out, there's always some meaningful number that get through. And now that it's just knocking out the Ukraine situation. So they're just everywhere you look, whether it's air defense, whether it's energy, whether it's the personnel, whether it's territory at the front, whether it's Pokrovsk, whether it's Kupiansk, whether it's Kharkiv, everywhere you look, the Ukraine side is losing more and more. And I just can't help but go back one more time to the enthusiasm of the U.S. senators, the elite of our country in the foreign policy. That's supposed to be the body that's experts internationally. And they're just cheering this on, oblivious to everything I just said.
Yeah. You heard what Larry said, his research said that Ukraine has the upper hand in nothing. Russia has the upper hand in everything. That on top of what Rubio just said, well, let's get them some new stuff, and then so what?
That's just where it is.
Yeah.
And it's just really sad. And the last thing we want to talk about a little bit here is at least as of the time we're making this show here, there still has been no attack into Venezuela, though we do still have a lot of combat power down in that region. A lot of people like us are talking about it, and it's on a lot of the major news. I've actually been on some regular newscasts. A lot of people are interested in that, so a lot of focus on it. And what I hope is that enough people are asking hard questions, and then what? So you want to go in and blow some stuff up in Venezuela. Towards what end? What are you going to accomplish? I really hope that enough people are focusing on this that we end up not doing anything stupid, and after some period of time, we just point a finger at Maduro and say, well, you better not do X, Y, Z, or maybe that we say, you know what, we're going to go ahead and accept your offer to let us take care of your oil for you, et cetera. And then we steam those ships back out, because anything else would be a really big problem for us.
What concerns me is that he was ordered, Pete Hegseth, Secretary of War, he's been ordered by President Trump to take action.
Yeah, that's the really worrisome part. President Trump ordered action and the Department of War is delivering. And like I said on the show, I think I did on Friday, that's he's a little too eager and enthusiastic about his title of Secretary of War and wanting to go down as a big warrior or warlord. I don't know what it would be the right term there, but it's his enthusiasm is a little bit troubling. But yeah, we don't know that. We don't know what that means. It was I think it was on Wednesday that there was a meeting in the White House that curiously did not include Tulsi Gabbard. We know is not for the regime change operations. I doubt that was an omission and an accident. Wow. And I hope she continues to press that issue there. And maybe, who knows, maybe once when she keeps talking to the president, maybe she can convey him with enough evidence that says this would be a really bad thing. And maybe that'll finally get through to the president. I don't know. I hope so.
Danny, just quickly, how could she possibly not have been invited to that meeting? What is there? Is there one morsel of evidence that, oh yeah, here's why it's a good idea?
They actually did address it. They said, oh, turns out she was overseas and wasn't back from her meeting yet. And I'm like, okay, there is nothing that she would have been doing overseas that would have been more priority than that. So if they wanted her there, I guarantee you they would have had her there. And instead, they made sure they had it before she was back. So yeah. I don't see any chance that was some kind of just a scheduling snafu.
Oops.
That was a decision. So we'll stay on top of that, too. We're going to stay on top of all this for you guys, obviously, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised. And before I let it go, I just want to check, Gary, because now I've got a little PTSD. You don't have any other videos that I don't know about coming up with Cody, do you?
No. And if anybody was watching, you missed an incident by an inch. Let's call it that. And you saved yourself. And if people were
now
watching.
Now you have PTSD, and I'm watching it. I saw the rear view, and I'm like, oh, snap. Cody's doing a Cody thing again. So yeah, so I did avoid that one. I just wanted to make sure there's anything more that I didn't know about. So
now I'll keep you abreast of his actions.
We really appreciate you guys a whole lot. And we wouldn't have a show there if it wasn't for you guys. We are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth, but without you showing up to hear the truth and sharing it with your friends, it would be a lot less effective. So thank you very much, folks. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Indeed.